From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said today he hopes the international community will soon be able to set a timetable to end Israeli settlements. The UN Security Council last week passed a resolution condemning settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem after President Obama ordered the U.S. to abstain from the UN vote rather than veto it. But Israel is reportedly moving ahead with plans for thousands of new homes in East Jerusalem. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins us from Jerusalem. Hi there, Daniel.
Hi.
So first of all, let us know, how is the UN Security Council vote resonating or reverberating in Israel?
Well, Israeli officials are furious. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said he's angry, he's frustrated. He says the Security Council resolution is hostile to Israel and that the UN should not be dictating terms on issues like settlements, but instead that those issues should be worked out in peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. And he's accusing the Obama administration of initiating and orchestrating this resolution from behind the scenes, even though U.S. officials deny that. And Netanyahu has taken an unusual step of summoning the U.S. ambassador for a meeting to protest. And he's also temporarily limiting Israel's diplomatic ties with countries that voted for the resolution, countries like Britain, France, Russia, China.
Now, the U.S. vetoed a similar resolution back in 2011. So why do we think this one was allowed to pass with an abstention?
Well, it's interesting. You know, this is not unprecedented because several U.S. presidents have allowed some resolutions like this to pass that are critical of Israel. The Obama administration says it's the first time that it has allowed such a resolution to pass. And as you said, in 2011, the Obama administration vetoed a resolution that focused on settlements. And the U.S. then said, you know, that resolution made it seem as if settlements were the only factor that threatened the prospects for a two-state solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you know, creating a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Now, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, says the circumstances have changed. She says settlement building has expanded, peace efforts have failed, and the U.S. has repeatedly said that increased settlement building in lands the Palestinians want for a state simply makes it harder to establish that state.
So given what you just said, Daniel, I mean, help us understand, how significant then is the move that President Obama made, also because his presidency is only going to last a couple more weeks?
Right. Well, first of all, it's a symbolic measure. It doesn't impose any penalties. It doesn't impose sanctions. It's being taken very seriously by the Palestinian Authority president. He says it's proof that the world rejects settlements. And he says that it lays the foundations for peace negotiations in the future. Of course, the Israeli prime minister is also taking it very seriously as a kind of a slap in the face by the world. And there's a conference happening in Paris coming up that is happening just a couple days before Obama leaves office. And it's a peace conference that might make some more changes in this regard.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, Israel is reportedly moving ahead with plans to build more settlements in East Jerusalem. What more do we know about those plans at this point?
What we know is what a pro-Netanyahu newspaper in Israel reported, that a planning committee is going to meet tomorrow to discuss plans for new Israeli housing units in East Jerusalem, which is a part of the city that the Palestinians want as the capital of an independent Palestinian state. And the deputy mayor of Jerusalem told the newspaper that we remain unfazed by the UN vote. And he also said that he hopes that Trump and Netanyahu will allow for more housing for Israelis in East Jerusalem. He said there had been less construction that took place during the Obama administration, and he wanted to make up for that.
Now, Daniel, you mentioned that there's this Mideast conference that President Abbas is staking his hopes on, the one that's to go ahead in Paris. It's already been moved once because France wanted to make better preparations. So assuming the conference does actually go ahead in mid-January, do you know what we can expect?
Right. The conference is set for January 15th, you know, just days before Obama leaves office. And many countries are expected to be present there, and they may back a plan for reaching Israeli-Palestinian peace. The Palestinian Authority president is staking hopes on the conference He's hoping a timetable will be set for ending Israel's occupation of the West Bank. And Israel is worried about the possibility that the U.S. might, at that conference, lay out a framework for how a peace deal would look, which Israel sees as unfair, as dictating terms.
Well, as you mentioned, a couple days after that, Donald Trump becomes president of the United States, you know, following his January 20th inauguration. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has very much embraced Donald Trump's election. Do we know how a Trump administration is likely to change things, if at all, between relations between the United States and Israel?
Well, it could change things quite dramatically, although it is too soon to tell. But from indications, Trump seems to have a completely different attitude when, first of all, when it comes to Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Trump's advisors have said he does not see them as a barrier to peace. Trump's pick for the U.S. ambassador to Israel is the head of a nonprofit that raises millions of dollars for a West Bank Jewish settlement. And with regards to the U.N. vote, Trump called on Obama to veto it, and he has said that when he takes office, things will be different at the U.N.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin speaking to us from Jerusalem. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
To many people, the past 15 years in public education have been a whirl of new tests, big initiatives, and data sets. Now, schools in Nashville, Tennessee are leading a national effort to bring back one of the basics, building strong relationships. But how they're doing it has some social conservatives on edge. Chaz Sisk from Here and Now contributor Nashville Public Radio reports.
His teachers say that a year ago, it was a struggle to get Andrew Gong engaged. That made it all the more shocking when 3 weeks into this school year, the fourth grader stood before the student body at Fall Hamilton Elementary School in Nashville to share a song he'd written.
Habit one is say it with me, be proactive, it is indeed. You won't ever do the wrong thing because you do you and I do me, yeah. Habit
two. His teacher, Jennifer Burnell, says the song came out of the blue.
And at first I thought that he found it online because there's a lot of them online. And then he, in the rap, it actually said specifically things that we had done in the classroom.
But not a song about math or reading or social. Studies. It was a song about being a group leader.
Set a goal and take the steps to reach the goal that you're waiting for, yeah.
For Andrew and other students in Nashville schools, this year's curriculum isn't just about acing standardized tests. It also includes lessons in what educators call social-emotional learning, working with others, listening, telling classmates that you care about them.
I will use my choices to do what's right, lift others with all my might. That's it.
That's really great.
Teachers at every school in Nashville work these ideas into their lessons. Students also meet every 2 weeks with dedicated instructors. And Nashville schools have been offering counseling services to children struggling emotionally with the recent election. It's called Social Emotional Learning. Nashville is part of an 8-city nationwide effort to figure out how to make these skills a bigger part of public education. The project is funded by a national nonprofit. Meanwhile, a Nashville charter school, Valor Collegiate, has received a grant from Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg to promote social-emotional learning. And state education officials are studying how to take the concept to other schools. Kyla Kringle leads the program in Nashville.
One of the things that we know is that you can't focus on just the academics. You have to have the climate and the academics together.
Social-emotional learning could be seen as a pendulum swing in public education. Reform efforts like No Child Left Behind put a premium on hard skills that can be easily tested, whether students have mastered multiplication or if they can write coherently about topics like the Cold War. Social-emotional learning, on the other hand, focuses on softer skills, such as team building and self-belief. Kringle says these skills are just as important.
Everybody has to feel that they belong. They have to feel connected in a school district, before they can open their minds and learn.
This is not something you do in a set time. This is something you do all day, every day, with your students.
That's right.
So I don't understand why we have to set it apart.
Just to acknowledge.
Republican State Representative Sheila Butt is one of the people pushing back against the program. She grilled education officials when they presented the concept at a hearing earlier this year. But says good teachers already understand how to create nurturing environments. Taking time out to teach those skills is at best a diversion of resources, she says. At worst, it's another way for bureaucrats to interfere in the classroom.
We're just using our students to try this out. And I honestly feel like teachers are doing this every single day with everything that the students do. So, you know, it's not something that I believe we need to jump into it.
Other conservatives worry social-emotional learning is a Trojan horse. Concepts like tolerance could be used to promote LGBT rights, for example. They say parents should be consulted. The critics don't sway Matthew Portell. He's the principal of Fall Hamilton. He says social-emotional learning brings the focus back where it should be.
We're not producing robots. We're not producing data points. We're not producing test scores. We're producing children.
Portell says most parents and teachers have been supportive, and he predicts any time lost teaching social-emotional skills will be made up with more productivity in the classroom.
It is what we need to do. It's what research shows what we need to do. In education, we've made some major shifts over the last several years, and unfortunately, a lot of times those shifts haven't included the kids.
Portell says the emphasis on emotional well-being has already improved discipline at his school. At this time last year, he says his office had dealt with 90 serious student discipline cases. So far this year, he says, there's been just 18. For Here and Now, I'm Chaz Sisk in Nashville.
This year, the artist Christo realized a dream he's had for more than 40 years. On June 18th, he debuted The Floating Piers, an almost two-mile-long walkway covered in yellow-orange fabric that stretched out into Lake Iseo in northern Italy. It connected two islands with the mainland. The project was up for only 16 days before it was dismantled and recycled, but in that short time, The Floating Piers received over 1.2 million visitors, double what the organizers expected. The Floating Piers was Christo's first large-scale project since he and his late wife Jean-Claude installed the gates in New York Central Park back in 2005. Their other projects include the Wrapped Coast in Australia, Wrapped Reichstag in Berlin, and Surrounded Islands in Miami back in 1983. Jeremy Hobson spoke with Christo via Skype from Lake Iseo back in June.
Christo, it is a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
So when did you and Jean-Claude first envision this project, and what was the original inspiration for it?
When first envisioned many, many years ago, which happened just after the wrapping of the coastline in Australia near Sydney, 1969. The first proposal for floating pier was for the delta of Rio de la Plata near Buenos Aires in Argentina. Hmm. Many of our projects, they deal with the connection between the fluidity of the water and sturdiness of the earth, like the Rapcos in Australia, like the running fence going in the Pacific Ocean. Basically, all that play between fluidity and the water and earth was very much in our work for many years.
And why was that so interesting to you, the difference between the water and the earth?
Visual artists understand something can move, something very sturdy, very simple. And, of course, the connection, how the water play with the earth and with the rocks, with the surface, with static. Basically, there are a lot of dynamics.
And in this case, people can actually walk out onto the floating piers.
That was the idea. To basically, in 1970, there was the proposal to build pontoon type. We put in wooden floor and cover with fabric, and the people will walk. Of course, the pontoon will move because it's not totally solid structure. Fortunately, we don't did that project at that time, but technology today to translate the motion of the water is so much more advanced, and I come later. Now, in 1995, we finished the Reichstag, and Jean-Claude and myself was always thinking about that project that we like to do people walking in the water, and we spent a lot of time in Japan, and we were looking for tranquil water that we can do the project. And the second attempt to do floating pier was in the Tokyo Bay, an area of Daiba. And we worked very hard between 1996 and 1997. But again, we failed to get permission from the government in Tokyo. And now Jean-Claude passed away in 2009. I am working on a project for a long time, the project for Mastaba and United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi since 1979. The project over the river since 1996. And of course, these two projects, they entangle with permitting process, with very complicated. And I say to my friend that I will become 8 years old in 2015, and I like to do something can happen very fast. Now, between 1958 and 64, we live in Paris, but we exhibit many times in Italy, and we did exhibition in Milano, Torino, Venezia, and Rome. And this is how we were scouting the lakes I know. We were looking for tranquil water, basically, lake. And right away, Lake Iseo was most suitable for our project. the lake half, in the middle of the lake, very tall island. It's called actually Monte Isola. Now, the idea was to connect the mainland with the islands, because in that islands, 2,000 people live, their houses and villages, and these people go from the island to the mainland by traghetto, by boat. They do not have a bridge. And this is how all the projects start, taking the island of Monte Isola, connecting it with the mainland and eastern part of the lake with the town of Sulzano, and created 3 kilometers. I only say in kilometers, don't ask me to convert in feet. 3 kilometers of the floating pier and 2.5 kilometers of pedestrian street. Now, in the early years, the floating pier was built by the typical pontoon, like everybody know, with wooden floor. But early 2000, Canadian engineer invented very intelligent, very simple system to create a pier who literally float, built by the system of the extruded cube. And they connected with giant screw. This is why they're very difficult to explain you how the surface works, because you need to experience it. It's like, almost like walking in the water.
Well, and as I hear you describe that, I also think about the enormous part of this project, which is just getting the funding, setting up the amount of money. This was a 16-point-something million-dollar project. That must take up a lot of your time as well.
You know, I understand we need to sell works, but fortunately, Jean-Claude and myself, we're the biggest collector of our work. Our principal storage is in Basel, Switzerland. And that is the golden mine who worked from late 50 to today. And this is why it allows us to be very free, independently sell the works and build this project. Yes.
Why not leave this project up permanently?
All our projects, they designed to be temporary. There are some permanent works, you know, works for the museum and collection. They're permanent. They stay forever. But that project, they're not only designed temporary, they designed for particular season of the year. Like the Central Park project was winter project. We like to have a lively street to see the gates. During the summertime, Central Park is like forest. When the Miami project and Florida 1983 surrounded island was spring project, because before the hurricanes come in Miami later in the season. And of course, that project is summer project. The floating pier, we have the longest daylight of the year, end of June. All the journey is the work of art. All the journey from the beginning to the end is the work of art. And the most beautiful part of floating pier that I discovered is to see entire project is about the people walking nowhere. About the feeling of the surface of the land or the water. And your feet, actually, many of the people walk barefoot. And they walk. It's not like going to shop, not going to see your friends. It's going really nowhere.
And what was it like in this case to complete this project without your longtime wife and partner, Jean-Claude, who, as you said, died in 2009?
I miss her all the time, you know. She loved that project very much. She was a very dynamic woman. Now, she was never stop. She can never sit. She's moving all the time. And she was really very energetic. And, of course, this is why this project is so much still with her, you know.
I read that the two of you wouldn't fly on the same planes because one of the planes crashed, you wanted to make sure that the other person would be able to continue the work.
Exactly, yes.
So what's next? You've talked about the mastaba, this permanent project, right?
You asked me to talk about the future, and a very important moment. I have only remaining few days to be with our baby. I don't like to think about anything else except that project. I have these 16 days to enjoy it from morning to night, the middle of the night. It's all about that project.
You talk about how this project can be felt by those who are able to walk along it. But I also want to say that one of the amazing images that I've seen, or many of them, are from the air. And a lot of your projects, they look really incredible, and you see them in a different way from above.
But really, the project should be walk. Of course, for the photograph, for the newspaper, they're photographing for the air. much of the pictures there before the project is open on June 18. Today, you cannot see anything of that. You see it from helicopter. It's full. It's like an incredible amount of people. And this is the most greatest pleasure. It's entirely motion of people walking.
So you don't think about what it's going to look like from above?
No, I enjoy it. I never take the helicopter, actually, really. I have no time. Entire project is designed, basically, it's like a huge boulevard or avenue. And this is why, against that organic shape of the island and curve, organic shape, you have this very straight line created, rencontre of several piers, like an area called the star, when three piers meet together. I just coming back on the boat when I was looking from the boat how that connection happened. It's very exciting. It's an incredible play of the immensity of the water with people walking in the water. The color of the fabric is dahlia yellow, but around the edge of the pier is continually wet, and of course the color is darker, mostly orangey, like a brick dark color orangey, with very painterly surface. And the people do not walk on the wet side. They really walk on the dry side. It's almost like abstract painting.
Is this the project that you're most proud of that you've ever done?
No, all of our projects, they're part of our life, you know. They're part of moment of our life, Jean-Claude and myself.
Well, Christo, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Christo spoke with Jeremy Hobson last June. This month, after years of setbacks, the European Union launched Galileo, its satellite navigation system. It's meant to rival American GPS. Joining us with more is the BBC's business correspondent, Russell Padmore. Russell, welcome.
Meghna, good to be back with you.
It's great to have you. So Galileo had a lot of setbacks, but does it work? Will it work?
Good question. It will work. The business premise of it might be very questionable. I can say that that's something for the long term. But Europe now has its own satellite navigation system. It will rival the American GPS system, which, of course, is in use by many businesses and ordinary consumers around the world, and the Russian system, GLONASS, as well. But at the moment, not enough satellites in orbit. So the new Galileo system is using partly the American GPS system, because at the moment, the signal is pretty fuzzy.
Now, of course, American GPS has been operational for a long time. And as you mentioned, yes, businesses, governments use it. It's become an integral part of our lives. It can resolve locations down to roughly 16 feet. So what's the necessity for a brand new system?
The argument from a European perspective would be something that's much more accurate. With the new Galileo system, you can track something to virtually the immediacy of a yard. And this is the selling point, as we heard from Thierry Dubois, who works at Aviation Week in Lyon.
So if you are, for example, a sailor and you use your emergency beacon, you will be located much faster and much more precisely. The current system locates you in about 45 minutes with a typical 5 kilometer radius. With Galileo, you could be located in 30 seconds. And in 30 minutes, you could be pinpointed with a 100-meter precision.
But Russell, clarify something for me. We're saying this is a European Union system. Is it publicly owned, privately owned? Who owns this new Galileo system?
It set out originally as a European project, but suddenly along the way, as the costs escalated and the involvement of other technology from other countries has helped to enhance the system, companies from India have taken part, Israel, Saudi Arabia and South Korea, but largely it's owned and operated by the European Union. When we come to the business side of things, yes, there will be uses such as air sea rescue, as we've heard. Let's say businesses want to track wherever one of their trucks transporting goods is going. Autonomous cars, you've mentioned, of course, mobile phones, smartphones, these cell phones, they are also going to use satellites. As I said, the technology is a bit fuzzy. So at the moment, it's not widely available. But the long term plan is there will be one system for consumers and a premium service. The consumer service will be free, but the premium service will cost a bit more. And that's the accurate part of this system.
So you have to pay extra to get that finer location resolution with Galileo.
Well, this is the thinking behind it. You've got to remember there's very much politics at play here as well. Europe wants to be independent from the Russian and the American system, and it does bring that on the political front. The business argument, I think, is going to be much longer term and depend on the creation of technology. But ultimately, you think about these autonomous cars. Would you like to be driving a car which is effectively tracked by a satellite, which can only track you under the American system to a few yards, or the European one, anywhere on the planet, tracking you down to 1 yard?
Russell Padmore is the BBC's business correspondent. Many thanks, Russell.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
As the year wraps up, you might be thinking about money, about your wages, how much you spend on the holidays, how much you need to save. Investors are also thinking about money, as they always do, as the Dow approaches the 20,000 mark. But the markets were not always so bright in 2016, and there were many other economic roller coasters to ride this year as well. Issues such as trade, jobs, and regulations surged throughout the 2016 presidential election season, and large institutions from Big Pharma to Samsung to the EU felt the financial earth beneath them shake. So let's look back at the past year with Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so number one on your list, U.S. stock market correction. Why was that one of the biggest stories of the year?
Okay, first of all, it was number one because I went in chronological order.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, what correction? Everyone's talking about Dow 20,000 right now.
That's right. It's funny, though. We started the beginning of this year in pretty bad shape when it came to the markets. And, you know, think back. It was a really weird time. We were not talking about how much we were going to grow. We were talking about, oh my gosh, maybe we're headed into a recession. Crude oil was down below 30 bucks a barrel. It was the lowest point since the year 2003. Hmm. And at that point, stocks were down more than 10% from their previous high point. That's an official correction. And it was such a weird way to start the year because it almost crept up on us. It was like every week, a few percent. And it kind of reminded me of that period during the financial crisis where you felt like, well, every day is another 500-600 points. Eventually yeah. we get to zero and good, it'll be over.
Yeah.
So we did come back from that. But boy, that was a fascinating time because people were very freaked out.
Yeah. So let me ask you, Jill, I'm dying to ask everyone who's in the business press, because on a day-to-day basis, we sort of hyperventilate around, around what the markets are doing. And like you said, sometimes they're for a good reason, a la 2008. But just in the answer you gave me, like we start the beginning of the year talking all about a market correction. We end talking about Dow nearing 20,000. I mean, from a consumer level, how are we supposed to take this day-to-day roller coaster?
Here's what I think. When I was a financial advisor, you say to your clients, hey, you know, this is a long game. So don't get so excited when the market's going higher and breaking through milestones like a 20,000 Dow or, you know, when we were worried about it the first time around, the 5,000 level NASDAQ in the year 2000. Don't freak out so much on the upside. Don't freak out so much on the downside either, because in the long term, chances are we kind of understand how markets behave. If you've got a long enough time horizon and you stick to your game plan, you don't mess around with it, chances are you're going to be okay. And this year is such a fabulous example of it. I don't think there is one analyst who could have predicted that we would have been in a correction in the first quarter and then talking about markets being 10% higher by the fourth quarter. So because no one can predict that, I always tell folks, just stick to your game plan, keep your expenses down, don't try to figure out where the man behind the curtain is. There's no man or woman behind the curtain. Stick to a passive investment structure. You'll probably be better off.
All those wonderful low-cost index funds. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So now let's talk about another big business story that really did have a tangible impact on many consumers across the country. And that had to do with the discovery that Wells Fargo employees had opened a few million accounts that they shouldn't have. So a big story. Remind us what happened.
This was like a throwback story in my mind. You know, if you think about any sales organization and how they incent salespeople to do business, you say, oh, well, you know, if you sell this many, you get a bunch of steak knives. And if you open this many, you get a free vacation. If you don't actually open enough, you get fired. And essentially, there was a culture that was created at Wells Fargo where they were trying to put into place something called cross-selling. Every time you have some relationship with a customer, you try to cross-sell and open up a different relationship in another part of that financial institution. There were people kind of far down the food chain, but clearly the folks above them knew what was going on. To hit these targets, what they did was they just opened up accounts without the customer knowing. Now, what was really kind of bizarre about it is that they would often open and close the account very quickly. So many times, if you're the customer, you didn't even know it was opened and closed, maybe until you went and checked your credit score and you realized, who made a hard credit inquiry into my record? And that may be how you discovered it, but it was hard to discover. What was also crazy about this case is that the bank's response was horrifying. Mm-hmm. They cut 5,300 low-level employees. You know, they were sort of like, oh, it's the bad apple, right? That's usually what
a lot of bad apples. Then, right?
A lot of bad apples. They paid $185 million fine to the regulators. And this story is going to continue to play out because all of the regulatory institutions that should have actually kind of been flagged about this didn't see it, or they blame management for not telling them about it soon enough. And in fact, the Federal Reserve, which oversees the big financial institutions in this country, has cracked down on every single one of them and said, tell us exactly what your cross-selling policy is. Tell us what's going on. We're keeping an eye on you now.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking banks, let's talk about America's central bank and the Fed. Raised interest rates only twice since 2006, once last December and once just last week. Obviously, this was a year of a great deal amount of political uncertainty as well. So the Fed staying the course more or less. But what do you expect from them in 2017?
Well, you know, when the Fed raised rates at its last meeting of 2016, they basically put together these projections. And they said, here's what we think we're going to do over the next year, 2 years, 3 years. And I think that generally speaking, they're trying to take all the information they have and project, right? And in 2017, they are anticipating an additional 0.75% in rate hikes. Okay. That seems all well and good, but I just want to remind everybody that in 2015, when they made that first rate increase, they thought they were going to do 4 1/4-point increases in 2016. Hmm. They thought they were going to raise by a full percentage point. And guess what? They did just one rate increase of 0.25%, proving that perhaps your local weatherman or weatherwoman is better at predicting short-term than your Fed governors and officials.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's wrap up with some good news here, because in 2016, we did see some wage gains. You write that this was a year where wages finally outpaced inflation, up 2.5% year over year in November. So what drove that?
Well, it's interesting because we talk so much about the problems in the labor market. I think we forget about how much progress we've made. And to take you back to the bad times, when 2009 started and well into 2010, we as an economy were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs on a monthly basis. And to come back from that hole, which was about 12 million jobs lost, to come back from that hole, we have had to create lots and lots of jobs. Now, I know it has not been perfect. I think a lot of the jobs created have not been high-quality jobs. But that said, in 2014 and 2015, we had very strong job creation. 2014, 260,000 jobs a month. 2015, about 220,000 a month. Through the month of November, which is the data that we've got right now, we have about 180,000 jobs a month. These are really good numbers. And what has happened is, as the labor market has tightened, companies are finally starting to pay more to these employees. And this is great news. As I said, it's not like a 2.5% increase year over year is awesome. But if inflation remains low, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So if you made 2.5% more than you did last year, and prices are only up by 2%, ostensibly, you should have some extra money that's left over, presuming you haven't spent it on the holidays.
So many ifs, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's a perfect way to end 2016. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money, thank you so much, and happy 2017 to you.
And to you as well.
It's Here and Now. What can I do? It's a question we've all asked at some point when someone we know is in pain. And so often the answer is, I don't know. Well, today we've got a story about a woman who felt speechless in the face of loss, but decided to try something small, and it grew. Erica Lance of Here Now contributor WBUR has the story.
As a young boy in Mechanicsville, Virginia, Nate Matheny had a habit of disappearing.
He'd sneak out the back door if you didn't keep an eye on him, and he would go onto people's front porches, and he would just stand under their wind chimes and listen to the wind chimes chime.
That's Nate's dad, Kevin Matheny. Nate was always drawn to sound, partly because he had Williams syndrome. It's a genetic condition that involves developmental delays and heart problems, and people with Williams syndrome often have hypersensitive hearing. Nate couldn't talk, but he sang or hummed almost all the time. One day, when Nate was 6, his parents noticed that he wasn't humming or moving. His lips were blue. Nate's sister, Caroline, was 9 years old at the time.
I was watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and like my parents started freaking out because they realized that he wasn't breathing. And they were on the phone with 911, and the 911 was telling them how to do CPR until they got there. And my mom noticed me just standing there looking in fear, so she shoved me into the office to watch my show.
They rushed Nate to the hospital, but doctors couldn't stabilize him. And after just a few hours, Nate died. His older sister, Caitlin, remembers seeing their dad the next day. For years, he'd given Nate his morning meds.
He woke up really early and he's like, what do I do with my mornings now? I just remember actually seeing him cry for the first time and him just looking desperate for what to do next.
3 days later, Tamara Letter, who knew Nate's mom, Diane, in high school, was at Nate's wake.
I felt the weight of that loss and it just felt so heavy. I wanted to help, but I didn't know how.
She mentioned this to another woman, and as the two of them stood next to Nate's casket, they formed a plan. They decided that, for 1 year, they would shower Diane's family with anonymous acts of kindness, and they'd recruit other women in different corners of Diane's life to join them.
We created a Facebook group. I chose 5 ladies, and Michelle chose 5 ladies. That was it.
They called themselves the Secret Sisters. Each of the 12 women was assigned a month, and for that month, they'd commit to 3 things. Pray for Nate's family every day, send small gestures of love throughout the month, and give one larger gift, all anonymously. Nate's parents remember getting that first card, signed, "From the Secret Sisters."
We immediately began investigating as to who these people were.
That looks like so-and-so's handwriting.
And thus began the stream of anonymous notes and gifts from the Secret Sisters. Tamara says she and the others usually made deliveries under the cover of darkness.
I was terrified that I would drive by their house and they would recognize my car. You know, when was the last time you ding-dong ditched somebody as a 40-year-old?
All of a sudden, it's like, whoa. There's a basket on the front porch, or there's something hidden in the mailbox, or there's something on the hood of the car.
Yeah. They were really creative.
The family was given crafts, food, and gift cards to movies and bowling alleys and restaurants, things to distract them from their grief. It touched Diane that these mysterious givers knew her son so well. She received one gift in particular that reflected Nate's obsession with ladybugs, a set of wind chimes, just like the ones Nate used to wander off to find. with small ladybugs dangling among the chimes.
I just started crying. I mean, it was joy mixed with grief. Nate was still being remembered.
You would hear those chimes go off just about every day. And it was just a subtle reminder that that's something Nate loved.
A year after Nate's death, his family received a large stuffed envelope from the Secret Sisters.
We're like, oh, what's it going to be now? And it was a puzzle.
When they put the jigsaw together, it formed an invitation to a picnic. It was finally time to meet the Secret Sisters. The day of the party, the 12 women from different parts of Diane's life gathered, nervously, under a shelter at the park. Then, Diane and her family arrived.
And they scanned across and saw all of us standing there. We all pretty much were in tears.
It was the best thing that could come out of a horrible situation.
Looking at all the friends gathered, Tamara saw that a little idea had turned into something big.
I realized that the seemingly small things that we do in life matter.
For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lance.
Erica's story comes to us from Kind World, a WBUR podcast about the power of individual acts of kindness. We've got more information about it at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.